What was our horror and surprise one day when six Burmese men walked straight into our midst. Of course, they were just as shocked as we were. They were trying to escape the Japanese and were coming over tiny jungle tracks rather than the main roads, and they'd run into us without any idea that there were any British in the whole of Burma. Of course, naturally, we couldn't let them pass, because if they'd gone on, well, they might have betrayed us, or they might have told the good news that the British were there, which would have soon leaked through and our whole expedition would have been finished. So we had to make them stay there. The only thing was we'd hardly anybody who spoke Burmese. And our soldiers had to point their bayonets at them, make them sit down and threaten them. Of course, they were terrified. They thought they were going to be killed. When I heard about this, I ran over and, speaking Burmese, I started talking to them to try and reassure them. And they said, but we've got to get on. Our wives will be so worried. We told them for certain we'd be in tonight. They may think we've been caught by the Japanese. I said, I'm very sorry. You've got to stay with us. They said, but why? I said, I can't tell you. They said, for how long? I said, I can't tell you. So obviously we couldn't tell them what we were going to do. But I said, you must stay with us until we'd blown up the bridges. However, it meant that the intelligence officer, of course, also spoke Burmese, and he and I got talking to them, and I got quite friendly and told them I'd been a missionary and what I'd been doing and where I'd been and one thing or another. And after a bit, I told them I'd been to all down that very area. One of them said, oh, they said, are you the missionary who came down on a raft and gave us medicines and showed us pictures and preached to us? I said, yes, I am. Of course, he didn't recognize me because of my beautiful beard, which I used to comb every day and part in the middle for variety. And this was an incident that I'd done as a missionary. I'd floated down with another missionary on a raft, and we'd stopped at every village all down this small river, and we used to go up and treat the people medically and preach the gospel. And he said, oh, yes, he said, I remember. I was in great pain, and my inside was going grup, 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 grup. And you came along, gave me some medicine, it was probably castor oil, and it made me perfectly all right. So, of course, that made us bosom friends. And then we tried to find out from him where the Japanese positions were and how many men were guarding every bridge along the railway. And he gave us a lot of useful information. And amongst others, he told us that about 20 miles north up the railway line, at a small town called Nanthe, that I knew quite well, he said, the Japanese have put a large ammunition dump in one of the Buddhist monastery areas. So we got him to pinpoint the thing as well as we could. He'd got no idea of map reading, but we finally got out of him. We wireless this message back to India. And the next day, our aeroplanes came in, and we could hear tremendous explosions. And from what we gather, those dumps were nearly all destroyed. In fact, our brigade alone, and there were a large number of brigades, our brigade alone reckoned that they had blown up 20 dumps of enemy ammunitions. Another thing, what was generally known as White City. I told you we had to block roads and railways. And there was one strategic place which we called White City. We all gave these American or English names so that nobody knew what we were talking about. And units came from various areas, making up nearly a brigade, and they cut the railway line completely. They also cut a small road that was running parallel with the railway line. And then there was a flat place of paddy fields, which they made as an airstrip, a very improvised small airstrip. And it was amazing. They flew in guns, 25-pound gunners, anti-aircraft guns, and they got themselves dug in the top of this little hill with barbed wire entanglement all round and every man living under the ground. Of course, as soon as the Japs discovered it, they were determined they must get us out because nobody could go up the road, nobody could go up the railway, and there were not other railways or roads. So they brought up large numbers of forces, they bombed them, they attacked them, but they simply could not get in. Brigadier Calvert, who was one of our magnificent leaders. He did a wonderful work at White City, as we called it. The only thing was that as time went on, it was, I think, 3 or 4 weeks afterwards, there were so many dead bodies lying round the fence outside. They were all putrefying. It was spoiling the water supply. It was making the place entirely unhealthy. And we felt the enemy were getting more and more men up, and unless we got out quickly, we might never get out at all. But how were we to get out? Because by this time, the Japanese had almost surrounded the whole place. Not quite. And so we had to do something about it. The brigade I was in, under Brigadier Brodie, was brought up, and we were to worry and annoy the Japanese that were surrounding our troops inside. Now, Wingate was a great believer in the Old Testament, and he greatly admired Gideon. Gideon was his great hero. And you know how Gideon, with 300 men, bluffed the larger Midianite army and got away with it. Well, now, we were to do the same. And we had far more Japs than us, but we had to come up, and we made a circle round them, and we'd rush in the middle of the night, throw hand grenades, fire guns, then dash back again, dash round a few hundred yards, dash into the circle again, do the same again, and all round, making a terrible noise, making the Japanese thinking that we'd far, far more troops than we had. The result was that for 2 or 3 nights, we kept them so occupied that they were worried about our attack, rather than defending keeping the people inside that they were wanting to. And the result was that in an amazing way, we had a breakthrough, and all the men that were inside, even the wounded, were all taken out. Airplanes flew in and took away the wounded, and even took away the heavy guns. So that a day or two later, when the whole place was empty, the enemy went in to find that there was nothing left there at all. It was certainly an amazing achievement, and this is, again, one of Wingate's great accomplishments, the kind of thing we were doing all the time. Now, of course, we did many other things, but I think I'll pass on from here onto the question of some of the difficulties we faced, because we had to face very many difficulties indeed. And it was not easy. There was the mental strain and the physical strain of it all. And to make things worse, General Wingate, who trained us, and we had the greatest confidence in us, had promised that none of us would be in longer than 6 weeks, 4 weeks probably, and then we'd be flown out in light planes. But unfortunately, he was killed. His plane crashed, and he was killed. And we came under General Stilwell of the American Army, who was known as Vinegar Joe, hated by the Americans, and certainly hated by us. He felt all the British were limeys and lazy and cowards. And he had no sympathy for our expedition. He'd never liked Wingate, nor did he like our expedition. And so he immediately said he was not going to allow any of us to go out until some more airborne commanders come in to take our place. Well, there were nobody trained. We had no more airborne commanders, and the monsoons was on. And so it meant we had to stay there right through the whole monsoons of over 3.5 months of continual rainfall, probably 100 inches of rain coming in that time. We had no tents, we had no shelters, we had no anything. We just lay down on the ground with a ground sheet over our head, and sometimes the rivers would swell up and we'd be almost swept away. You were in the same clothes night and day. We had no change of clothing whatsoever, and for 6 months we were in the same clothes, and you were soaked to the skin, you just dried as you marched on. And so this was perhaps the greatest disaster coming under Stilwell. He'd no sympathy, he didn't mind whether we were all killed. And he later tried to make us attack towns when we were not trained for that. We'd no guns or anything, and we lost very heavy casualties. The other thing was, of course, that we were in dense jungle. And if I may just put it in language that perhaps some of us may understand, if you were out all alone in a dark, dense area, vast area, with no houses anywhere near, you might feel a little nervous. But if you were in the middle of a dense, huge forest that had got Japanese anywhere, you didn't know where they were, you had no idea whether they were north, south, east, or west of you, and they perhaps were watching you and tracking you, I think you'd agree you'd be in a far worse state. And on top of that, of course, we had wild animals. We had plenty of tigers, bears, cheetahs, panthers, and other animals, and leeches all around us, all the time. And the result was that, as I showed you on that pivot tree, we'd go up and we'd just lie down on the ground. When you were trying to sleep, you never knew whether the Japanese hadn't seen you and were following up closely behind. And the next moment you'd wake up with mortar bombs being dropped in your midst. And so it naturally got an awful strain on one. And you'd go asleep, half asleep, and you'd suddenly wake up. You heard a sound. I said, what was that? Was that the enemy? Or was it a wild animal? Or perhaps it was only one of the leaves falling off the trees. You see, we were under a lot of the teak leaves, and they're huge big leaves, and when they fall down, they make quite a crackle. And we sometimes found that. Or you'd say, or is it only my imagination? And often it was only that. And so the strain was very great. And then, of course, the lack of nourishment, the physical strain and everything else meant that some of the men found it too much and they committed suicide. Others, of course, bravely went on. And I'm going to read you a report from our colonel, which shows you I'm not exaggerating, to show you what appalling condition we were in at the end. Nobody, for one moment, never had Wingate imagined that we were going to be left for 6 months. Nobody had ever thought that British troops could live without tents or shelters or anything, in the pouring rain, night and day, day and day, night, without any shelters or without anything. Our wounded had to be carried. At the beginning, we used to make small light airstrips for men to fly in, but once the monsoons came, it was almost impossible. And really, the difficulties were very great indeed. The mules were sinking up to their waist in mud. Then we were ordered to go over to help another battalion at a place called Blackpool, and we tried to stagger up a mountain of 3,500 feet, and we were just slipping back. We just couldn't do it. I think I'll read you just extracts from our colonel's report at the end, which he was officially sent up to headquarters, which will show you this is the official report. We flew into Burma on April the 1st, 1944. The first monsoon rains, he said, fell on May the 15th, the day predicted. For the next 3 months, men and animals were to struggle on through the monsoons in the face of increased sickness and weakness from lack of food. This was the first time in history that a force was deliberately to remain in the jungle, fight and be aggressive during the monsoons of Burma. Muleteers were to see their precious mules weaken and die of exhaustion. They were to see them flounder to their bellies in mud and swamp, and to be dispatched mercifully by an officer's rifle as they pitifully and gamely tried to struggle on. We were all to see robust men waste away to skin and bones, and to fall exhausted from sickness and weariness, and to die before they could be evacuated. We were all to see the devastating effects of continuous rain, jungle gloom, mud, and toiling, back-breaking marches were to have upon men's minds as many cheerful, normal men became depraved, collapsed, and asked to be left to die, or even hastened their end by their own hands. These were only the weather and the elements that I'm talking about that had to be fought and defeated. In addition to this, was the enemy, the Japanese, who were still to be harried and destroyed throughout it all. And then skipping over some time, he says, all ranks were now becoming more exhausted and weaker every day. Sickness, hard going, and lack of rations were daily making their mark on men who had once been so fit. Men's stomachs were already revolting against the K rations, which had now been our only rations. These rations were originally planned for short expeditions of about 10-day duration, but were to be practically our only diet for the whole time we were behind the enemy lines. We'd had no proper meals since leaving India, and we'd had no bread at all for over 6 weeks. The four small finger biscuits in the K rations were a poor substitute, and these had been cut to half during our lean periods. This lack of bulk from no bread, meat, or vegetables resulted in stomach shrinking and general emaciation. Occasionally, but very seldom, the more tasty bits of a mule, when destroyed, were added to our dreary diet. Fortunately, we got a brief relief in our rations at one place. At that place, some loaves of bread were dropped to us by air, as all our food was dropped by air periodically. And even the issue of one slice of bread per day for each man made our meal a banquet for many days. In addition, they dropped to us some tins of fruit, and even though the scale was perhaps one tin per 50 men, the one slice of tinned peach was considered the most precious luxury possible. And then, near the end, he says, two great tribulations were added to the suffering of the men. Through being continually wet, feet became soft and swollen, and mud-soaked gritty socks caused inflamed irritation. Many men who removed their boots were unable to get them on again, and had to march in socks and puttees. Also, a virulent form of prickly heat made its appearance, and the men's bodies became smothered in pulsating boils which spread rapidly. Jungle sores like ulcers became prevalent on arms and legs, some of these as big as teacups, and attracted a black rim of flies or eye flies exposed for any length of time. On August the 26th, 1944, we were flown out of Burma, having been behind the enemy lines since our fly-in on April the 1st. It was a sorry sight to see these sick and distressed men dragging themselves along or being helped by the others. Most were unrecognizable, being shadows of their former selves. 12-stone men now only weighed 7 stone or 8 stone, and their sunken faces and hollow staring eyes gave signs of their awful condition. Even the others were little better, as all were half-starved, emaciated, and racked with dysentery, malaria, and jungle sores. Only the will to live had kept many of them going, once the end had come in sight. Of the original number of 900 in the two columns, 500 had already been killed or died, or been evacuated wounded, or very ill. Of the remaining 400 who made the final evacuation from Burma, all but 12 men, two of whom were officers, were admitted to hospital in India within a month and remained there off and on for the remainder of 1944 and into 1945. That was his report. I had the privilege or otherwise of being one of those two officers that did not go into hospital. Time is always run out. One might say, what did you as a chaplain do? Well, of course, it's totally different from any ordinary thing. We'd no churches, we'd no ordinary parades. I had a very wonderful service just before we flew in, which I made a special appeal, and a number of the men came to me to decide for Christ. We also had been given by headquarters a wonderful little book, a very, very small book, about 30 pages, that we could all put in our breast pocket, of prayers, hymns, and psalms. And as, of course, usually we were not allowed to talk out aloud, no singing was allowed, we couldn't have an ordinary service, but I'd gather men, perhaps a dozen or 20 round me, and I'd say, now look carefully, page 12. There's a hymn. Now read it down carefully and think of it, apply it to ourselves. And I might make a few comments, but we couldn't sing. Then I'd point them to certain prayers. I'd make a little prayer of my own. I'd perhaps do a little reading and a very short talk. Another thing was at the pivot tree. When we gathered in at the pivot tree, while it was still black dark, sometimes I made the arrangement with the colonel. I'd walk to the centre and take off my cap. That meant everybody knew I was leading in prayer, praying for them. Then I had a little scripture gift mission book, which I'd read two or three verses under a theme, and say a short, very short prayer. We all put our caps on, though most of them had not heard the prayer, and we'd proceed. Then, of course, fortunately, I'd done some medical work, and so I was able to help medically. And I used to listen into the radio and tell the men the latest griff, as they called it, of the war in Europe, which was going well. I also got an idea that was worked very well, and that was before we left, we got our library, and we gave every single man one novel, book to read. And we suggested he didn't throw it away when he read it, but he passed it on to somebody else. And that, in spare times, helped them to have something to read. One hasn't time to tell of other things, but it was more through personal work and small contacts. Let me just close with Wingate's order for the day, just before our expedition was flown in. These were his words. He said, "You are now about to embark on a daring expedition that will go down in history for its audacity and ingenuity. And when in the days to come you tell your friends of your exploits in Burma, you'll be proud to say, 'And I was there.'" Thank you very much.